Good morning, everybody. So here we are, Romans 10 today, as we continue to kind of work our way through the book of Romans. And a great, great passage today, and a classic passage. A couple of sections in these verses today that are like world famous, actually. Like as we read through this, you'll be like, oh yeah, I know those verses. I've heard those verses before. So great little section for us today. Look, in his book, The Perfect Storm, Sebastian Junger tells like a devastating story. You've probably heard about it. You might have read that book. You might have seen the movie, which was also entitled The Perfect Storm. The ship, the Andrea Gale, a 72-foot commercial fishing vessel, headed out into the North Atlantic on a fishing trip in October of 1991. And the goal, like always, was to fill the freezers with thousands of pounds of fish. This was the occupation and the passion of this six-man crew. And they were really good at this. They actually said they were the best at it. And they were veterans at this. But this trip was different. A storm that was later called the Perfect Storm, was brewing and building. There was this low-pressure system that was moving down southward from Canada, and it was going to meet with Hurricane Grace, which was moving northward over the southern Atlantic, and the weather forecasters were delivering warnings, do not go out. The port authorities were delivering warnings, do not go out. The family of the crew members were listening to all of these warnings, and they were pleading with their family members, the crew, saying, please stay in port. But the crew ignored them all. This seasoned veteran crew, they looked at the weather. It was calm in port. They thought, you know, we've heard the weathermen say things before. A lot of times they're wrong, and we need the money. And they decided they were good enough to beat any storm. And when the storm hit its full power, the waves were over 100 foot big. The wind was blowing at over 75 miles per hour. And the Andrea Gale and the crew were not good enough to beat that storm. The ship was capsized, lost at sea, the entire six-man crew lost. And I remember reading it was a heartbreaking story because it could have all been avoided if they'd only listened and not gone fishing. I mean, the pain and the loss of all of those surviving family members was just gut-wrenching as I read the book. If only they had listened. Romans 10 describes a similar situation in a spiritual sense. The Israelites have received all of the good advice and all of the instruction from God and God's prophets, and then they had Jesus come to them in the flesh and tell them how to live and how to know God. But they didn't listen either. They ignored it all. They were headed into like this spiritual storm, but it was a storm of the destruction of their souls. And Paul, as he's starting here in Romans 10, is brokenhearted by their refusal to accept Jesus as Lord. So turn to Romans 10, verses 1 and 2, and we'll just start reading through this, and I'll explain a few things as we make our way through Romans 10. Brothers and sisters, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. Like, you hear his heartbreak in that. Back in chapter 9, he actually even said, I would be damned and be willing to go to hell if my fellow Israelites would come to faith in Jesus Christ. He loves them so passionately. In verse 2, he says, for I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. So they're filled with zeal, they're filled with excellence, but it's misplaced. Verses 3 and 4 tells us a part of like why they refused to receive this message of Jesus, because they wouldn't submit to the information that Jesus was God. Verse 3, since they did not know the righteousness of God and sought to establish their own. And you could put the word righteousness in there. They sought to establish their own righteousness. They did not submit to God's righteousness. Christ, so this is Jesus Christ, he is the culmination of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. But instead of acknowledging this truth about Jesus being God, they continued in their personal zeal to try to meet the standards of the law, and it was always an impossible task. But they wouldn't listen to the message. They did have lots of opportunities, and one of them, it tells us as we continue reading in verse 5, was Moses. Moses writes this about the righteousness that is by the law. And so what this says here, Moses says it, it's also written in the book of Leviticus, is this concept in this phrase here, the person who does these things, which means follows all of the laws, will live by them. So there was always in the law this kind of this teaching and this idea, if you can obey all of it, you will live, you will thrive, and you will have all of the blessings upon your life that God would give. The problem was nobody could do it, but they were so zealous to try. It tells us that there is a different kind of righteousness in verse 6, and it's a righteousness that's by faith. And that says, don't say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? That's to bring Christ down. Or, who will descend into the deep? That is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you. It is in your mouth. It's in your heart. That is the message concerning faith that we proclaim. Now, Paul here is quoting in verses 6 and 7, a couple of places from Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And what he's doing is he's like blending them with Jesus. And it's confusing to us probably as Gentiles because we don't know these Old Testament passages as well. But the Jewish audience would have understood that. And here's basically what he's saying in verse 6. You don't have to run up to heaven to get salvation. Christ has already come down to you. It also says you don't have to raise Christ from the dead because that's already happened. So what he's trying to say to them in a way that would have communicated to them but is a little confusing to us is, look, everything you need for salvation has already been provided through Jesus Christ. There's no need to try to attain it by following all of the laws. You have great zeal to follow all of these laws. That's not how it's attained. It's attained through Jesus Christ. That's really the message throughout the Bible of salvation. It's already been done for you. Will you submit and accept it? I like the way Rick Warren describes this idea. He says, every other faith is based on the word do. Do this and this and this and this, and then you'll get to heaven. Christianity is based on done. It's been done, finished, and you just accept it. So this was news that the Israelites, they couldn't accept this. And if you skip ahead, I'm not going to read these verses, but if you have your Bibles, you can look ahead to the end of chapter 10. Three other Old Testament characters were also saying the same message way back then. King David in verse 18, Moses again is quoted in verse 19, and Isaiah in verses 20 and 21, all clearly saying, no one can perfectly obey these laws. Even before Jesus came, the point was the law was supposed to reveal to them, you need something outside of obedience to the law to experience salvation. A savior is needed. But they wouldn't listen. They're like the crew of the Andrea Gale. They were seasoned spiritual veterans. They looked at the spiritual culture around them that they had built. They had their rituals. They had their traditions. They had their temples. The rabbis knew the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, they knew it all by memory. They would blow us away with their knowledge of those first five books of the Bible. They were experts. Yet they refused to submit to an untrained prophet from a small country town. That's Jesus. Jesus came on the scene and they were like, we're rejecting that message. You don't fit our expectations of what a Messiah would look like. And they refused to submit. Now, in stark contrast to that, the Gentiles, they were listening. They saw all of Jesus' miracles and like, oh, check. That's amazing. They heard his teaching with authority. And they're like, wow, we've never heard that before. Check. They heard about and saw that Jesus had died. Like, no chance about the fact that he was not dead. Well, that's a little bit of a confusing little thing. We thought he was a pretty amazing Messiah. But then he rose again from the dead. Oh, check. That's amazing. Over 500 people saw him, eyewitnesses. People touched him. People were with him. People heard him. People were in his presence, and the word spread like a wildfire. And the Gentiles, they were believing that Jesus was the Lord with such frequency that they were changing their cities and ultimately changing the world. They're a model, really, for us of what it says, and we're going to read some verses as we carry on here, of what it looks like, what's involved in a person being saved. Look at what it says in verse 9. If you declare with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. This verse and the next one, these are some of the famous ones. You probably know these already. For it's with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it's with your mouth that you profess your faith and you're saved. As Scripture says, anyone who believes in him will never be put to shame. For there's no difference between Jew and Gentile. The same Lord is Lord of all and richly blesses all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So in contrast now to the Israelites who are refusing to submit and refusing to believe, what we're seeing here in these verses is, well, who can be saved then? If we can't meet the law, if we can't make a righteousness that's good enough for us, who can be saved? And these verses are really saying anybody. But it's not fuzzy. Salvation is not belief in some mysterious higher power. Salvation is not, you know, like, well, I'll just call him any God I want to. Salvation is not experienced through some type of yoga chanting. Salvation is experienced only through Jesus Christ. So I've used these exact verses countless times to explain to a person what is required and involved in experiencing Jesus Christ as their Savior and Lord. Verses 9 and 10 make it really clear that you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. But like, I want to talk about that phrase for a second, Jesus is Lord, because it's not like a mystical little phrase. Like, it's not like a chant that if somebody just says the phrase Jesus is Lord, then all of a sudden, way to go, salvation is experienced. What it does mean is this, that a person was so fully convinced that Jesus was God in the flesh, who died on the cross and then rose again from the dead, that they would be brave enough to say, Jesus is Lord. That's what it means. Now, let me explain historically a little bit about what's going on in the first century to sort of back up what I'm saying there. So, Christianity during the first century was growing and spreading like crazy. But that doesn't mean it was popular. Paul himself wrote about being stoned for the gospel. He talked about being threatened physically about the gospel, about angry mobs running him out of town. Because Christianity turns the power structures of the world upside down. And if you're fully invested, if a person is fully invested in the power structures of this world, Christianity is threatening. And a lot of people were feeling threatened. As a result, opponents of Christianity, they worked like what I'd call a legal angle, and they convinced the authorities to make being a follower of Jesus Christ in many of the little regions illegal. So, and here was the reasoning. They say to their authorities, like, well, aren't we supposed to say that Caesar is Lord? And they were like, yes, we are. Like, so how can these Christians say Jesus is Lord? Like, there's a contradiction there. They can't say the two at the same time. So they pressed the issue and they forced people to choose. So what would happen is if somebody who was antagonistic against a Christian, they say, you know what, I'm frustrated with this person. I'm mad at them for whatever reason. They would drag them before a judge. And the judge would say, all right, look, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you will be killed. It's a capital crime. However, if you're not, you can go free. So the question was, what's your declaration? Is Caesar Lord or is Jesus Christ your Lord? So if the person said Caesar is Lord, they're immediately released. Everything's fine. If they said Jesus is Lord, then the judge would say, okay, let me re-explain what's going on here. You understand this is a capital crime. So I'm going to give you a second opportunity. What is your declaration? If they said Caesar is Lord, then they're free to go. Everything's fine. If they said again, a second time, Jesus is the Lord, then he would re-explain the situation again to them. So there was no cause for confusion. All right, you've said it twice. They gave them three opportunities. He would say, what is your declaration? And if they said a third time, Jesus is Lord, that's when the judge would say, take him away for execution. If they said Caesar is Lord at that point, even after twice saying Jesus was Lord, if they said, you know what, I got kind of caught up in the moment. Caesar is Lord. I got a family to take care of. I got like things to do. I have things that are important in my life. What am I doing here? If they said even then, Caesar is Lord, everything was fine. All right, good. Thank you very much. Go on your way. Everyone knew about the torturous executions that the Romans would use on the Christians after they gave three declarations that Jesus is Lord. There was no quick death for them, and there was no appeals process. Sometimes they would put them on tall poles, cover them with tar, and light them on fire to light the streets. Sometimes they take animal skins, sew them into their skin, and throw them in the arena and let the animals sort of have games with them as the crowd would cheer on. Sometimes, if they were sort of the lucky ones, I suppose, they'd give them weapons and put them in the arena and have them do sort of like battle with the trained gladiators. Regardless of the method, they all died torturous deaths. So a confession of Jesus is Lord was not made lightly. If a person was willing to say it, they had to believe it in their heart. Otherwise, you would just say, oh, it's fine, Caesar's Lord, no big deal, let me go on my life. I kind of like the Christians, they're like nice people. Like, I like sharing meals with them. Like, they seem so loving and compassionate, but I'm really not into it that much. Look, when you said that, man, you were willing to hold nothing back. It's like you're banking your entire life on Jesus. Like, that brings a whole new level of insight into verses 9 and 10, doesn't it? That's the attitude of the heart of a person when they become a Christian. It doesn't mean that you have to die today. I mean, that's not happening in America. I know many people would say in America, we live in pretty soft times, and sometimes we even feel a little guilty about the fact that we don't experience the kinds of threats and persecutions. And people wonder, how would I stand up against those kinds of threats? I don't think we ever know until we're in those situations. But what it does mean, even for us, living in times that are not as dangerous, is that when we give our lives to Jesus, we're staking our entire life upon that. We're not holding anything back from Him. I remember years ago, one of my youth leaders came to me and he was in great distress. It looked like he'd been crying, and he said he needed to talk with me immediately. And so what he shared shocked me. He had been leading a high school Bible study for 2 years, and he was so fun, like crazy, like high energy, super friendly guy. And he told me, look, I've been leading a double life. And he wanted to come clean. So he described how the party scene in Hermosa Beach had pulled him in, and he was doing things almost on a daily basis that he was ashamed of. And for about 10 minutes, he went on to kind of describe this crazy life that he had been living, like an out-of-control party animal. I'd never heard a confession like it. And when he was done, I asked him, I said, so what do you want to do now? And he said, I want to stop playing games, and I want to surrender to Jesus. So I turned in my Bible, and I explained Romans 10, verses 9 and 10. And I said, look, a Christian doesn't live a double life like that, with, like, a divided heart. And he said, look, I'm completely in. I want to surrender my entire life to Jesus. And so we prayed together. And then when we got done praying, I looked up to him and I said, you know what? I think you just became a Christian. And he said, I agree. I've known about Jesus for years, but I've never been willing to submit to him. And then I said, I can't believe you've been leading a Bible study for 2 years. And we both laughed at the irony of that and the newfound joy of his salvation. That's what happens when a person becomes a follower of Jesus. Right? Like we acknowledge, like, we're a mess. We don't refuse to submit. We believe in our heart that God raised Jesus Christ from the dead. And then in some way that comes out of our hearts as we acknowledge and confess, Jesus is my Lord. I am His. He can lead me in any way He wants to lead me. He can change me in any way He wants to change me. And yeah, we struggle with getting rid of our old junk. But at a heart level, we are undivided as it comes to God and Jesus. And look, this is a common experience of millions of people through history who have become a follower of Jesus Christ. And maybe even as I'm explaining this, maybe you're thinking, gosh, I don't know if I've ever done that. If you've never surrendered your heart to Jesus, like I'm describing right now, what that would mean is that you're not a Christian. But you can be. Salvation is offered to everyone for free. You know, so all of us could, at some points in our lives, we could be like the crew of the Andrea Gale and like the Israelites who say, forget about it. I know how to do it. Forget about it. I'm going my own way. I refuse to submit to all of the truth and the logic and the reasoning. Or we could be like so many others who hear the truth and say, man, that's what I need. I need a Savior. So the chapter transitions in a kind of a significant way here, and we're going to transition with it, and then we'll kind of come back to this moment of decision and this moment of receiving Jesus as we kind of think about what's going to happen at our end of the service today with our communion. So if you're already a follower of Jesus Christ, already a believer who surrendered, this next section is for you. So here's the progression in Paul's logic. In this chapter, first, he talks about the Jews who have been temporarily set aside because they refuse to submit. Then he talks about, look, anybody can be saved right now. And now he's going to take the next step in verses 14 and 15 to say, since the gospel is for everybody, go and tell them. Follow along with what it says in verse 14 and 15, a couple of other pretty famous verses that I bet you will know. How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one whom they've not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. So this is one of like the great missionary texts of the whole Bible. Like, why do we have missionaries? Why do we hold glow hunt events? Why do we invite people to come to church on Easter? Like, why do we like have a burden to talk with our friends about Jesus Christ? It's because of these kinds of verses right here. The scriptures tell us you have an amazing message. Don't keep it to yourself. Tell others about it. So there's like five links in this chain that we'll put up on the screen. He says, how will you call on the name of the Lord? He says, you call on the name of the Lord to be saved. And then I guess we don't have those, do we? I thought we had those on the screen, but I guess we don't. So there's five links, steps to this thing. He says, you call on the name of the Lord to be saved. And then he says, how can you call unless you believe? And then he says, well, how can they believe unless they have heard? Well, then how can they hear unless someone preaches to them? And then how can they be preached to unless somebody goes to talk to them? Right? There's the kind of the progression. It's pretty clear. So the experience of telling somebody else about Jesus, it can be exciting. It's one of the most like exhilarating things in my life. I also got to tell you, it's pretty terrifying. Like, we get our identity all kind of wrapped up in our relationship with Jesus. And so if a person rejects Jesus, we feel rejected. And we don't like that, right? I get that. I feel that at times. And I've trained a lot of people in evangelism and talking to others about Jesus. And here's just what I want to tell you. Many of you have gone through the evangelism training. Those of you who have not gone through that yet, here, let me just tell you basically what everybody experiences and feels, because you feel it as well. We are all afraid. I don't know what that is. Like, there's some sort of a human emotion about it. I think there's some spiritual warfare and some attacks that happen on us as well as we step into conversations about who Jesus is. And then adding to the pressure, look, I don't think people on the peninsula are all that interested in talking about Jesus or spiritual matters. I've talked to lots of people about spiritual things, and most of the time, people have zero interest to engage it at all. But that doesn't mean that we can just sort of ignore these verses, right? There's still the instruction to us from our God to go and tell. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And what's going to really help here is a proper understanding of the word preach. It's used two times in there. And I think an understanding of this word is going to really help bring increased thoughtfulness to your conversations. Because he's not talking about like a pastor or a missionary here. The Greek word for preach is herald in this section. There are other times in the New Testament where the word preach is different. In this section, it's a herald. And so here's what happened. A herald would make an announcement or they would spread a message. Heralds were quite common in the first century, and they were almost like a living newspaper. Sometimes they enter a town with a message from another region, and they deliver some news about something that was going on. Sometimes they would enter a town before someone famous, and they would herald their arrival. Because the famous person didn't want to sort of enter town and everybody's busy doing their activities and preoccupied with their own lives. And this famous, pompous person starts walking in and nobody notices. So a herald would go before them declaring somebody important is coming. Pay attention. Get ready. So the emphasis on being a herald is not on the messenger. The emphasis is on the message. The herald could be booed or ridiculed for the message that they gave. Did that change the fact that a neighboring town might be experiencing a smallpox outbreak? No. The herald's role was simply to tell the news. God wants everyone who's a Christian to be a herald to the message of Jesus. That's the point that he's making here, because God uses people to reach people. That's how God works. All of us have come to Christ because of somebody. Somebody in your life, as you think back, was a part of you learning about it, hearing it, so that then you could believe and then you could call upon the name of the Lord. All of us, I guess, in essence, could think about it this way. We have now a responsibility, when we believed it in our hearts, to tell others that they can do the same. Like, so the question, that, which is a probing one and a painful one, is if we don't tell our neighbors, who will? Now, what makes this a little, I guess, messy is that we probably have all been around obnoxious and offensive ways where people herald who Jesus is. And so I think a lot of people just kind of cringe, like, I don't want to be that person. What I want to offer up here are hopefully some really practical and helpful tips about how we can, in a winsome and a relationally authentic way, herald who Jesus is. Because we have to herald. I think the scriptures are pretty clear. We have to do it. But I don't want to do it in an obnoxious way. So I've found the book Becoming a Contagious Christian by Bill Hybels, like, very insightful on this topic. The whole book is on this. I'm just going to pull out a couple little sections on it and give you some instruction that I think will be insightful as you think about being a herald for Jesus. What he says in his book is, there's lots of stuff, but he kind of breaks it down into two categories. There's an indirect and a direct way that we can herald who Jesus is. In the indirect method, it would be described like this. You bring up spiritual matters without asking them for a response. So that you drop comments into conversation about spirituality. You drop comments into your conversations about church and maybe even about God. But you do not ask them anything. Now, the direct method, distinctly different, would be this. Is that you would actually ask someone a question that requires a response. So you're pretty straightforwardly raising some kind of a spiritual topic, and you're seeing if they would be interested to talk about that, because you're asking something from them at that point. Let me just give you a few examples, right? So as an indirect method, somebody might say, and this isn't just like a passing comment, but let's just say you're talking to a pretty good friend and you guys are just like hanging around, like, man, and they say to you something like, how is your life going right now? Like, how are you really doing? Now, you could give a response like this. You got to tailor these to be kind of like for you, right? You could say, you know what? Financially right now, you could say whatever. In my family, I kind of feel like things are going pretty well, or maybe there's a couple struggles. You could kind of say whatever's going on there. You could say spiritually, things are whatever, going great. I'm a little confused, right? Like, and then you could just throw it out, like, which one do you want to talk about? Like, which one are you interested in right now? Now, you are asking them to give a reply at that point, but man, you're giving them a lot of options to choose from, right? And if they're a non-Christian, they might be totally intrigued, like, wow, like, spiritually, like, tell me more about that. But maybe they'll be so petrified of that, they'll be like, oh my gosh, they want to talk about spiritual things. How's your family? Let's talk about your family, right? Like, they go that route. That's fine. You're letting them, with the indirect method, you're kind of letting them dictate the next steps. Another one could be, I get this one all the time, like if we're talking about the weekend. Somebody say, hey man, what are you going to do this weekend? And I'll say, well, you know, like, I'm coaching my son's baseball team. I love coaching, so we're going to do that on Saturday. And then, I'll say, I'm working out on, I love going on this great run, or I'm going to go to the gym or whatever. And then I'll say, you know what, on Sunday I'll be going to church. You know, I'm a pastor and I just love that so much. And that's all I say. They can ask a follow-up question if they would like. They rarely do, but they could. All right, another example. You know, like, if you've got a pretty good friend who's not yet a believer, and you guys are hanging out, talking, going on a walk, whatever it is, and there's kind of an opportunity for you to just kind of fill in some blank space, you could say, you know what, this morning or this week, I got to tell you, I was reading the Bible, and I came across the most amazing thing. And you just give them a couple little kind of summary sentences of like what the Lord is teaching you, and then you just let it be. If they want to talk about it, they'll ask you questions. If they don't want to talk about it, they'll change the subject very quickly. You do not need to rescue them. So that's the indirect method, right? You're kind of floating invitations out there, nothing more. And if they want to engage it and keep it going, that's fine. Let them do it. And I think in a lot of ways, that's like a herald, right? A herald would come into town. They'd make their pronouncements. And after they made their announcements and pronounced things, maybe the people on the streets would talk to each other. Did you hear what they just said? I don't know if I like that. I don't know if I agree with that, right? People can talk about it themselves. People could ask the herald follow-up questions if they wanted to. Hey, what do you mean there's a smallpox breakout? Is it coming our way? I want to know more about that. I'm concerned about that. Or people could totally ignore what the herald had to say. It's not really the herald's responsibility how people react. Nor is it our responsibility for how people react when we talk about Jesus. That's the Spirit's job as He works in a person's heart. I was thinking about different examples and such. Here's a pretty recent one that's happened in our family. So 3 weeks ago, Cassie, my wife, went up with Amanda Panduris, our kids ministry director, with kids and three other wives and their kids. Three of them were not yet believers. And they went up to Mount Rose. They went skiing together and they're all hanging out. And as they're sitting around the hotel one night, they're enjoying the fun company. Like the kids were like in this blissful moment of happiness. It's almost like they had little halos around their heads. They had a great time on the mountain that day. And it was just kind of one of those special little moments in life. And one of the ladies who's not yet a believer was just so filled with happiness. She said, you know what? Like, you guys are so good. Like recently, ever since my dad died, I've been making a point to hang out with really good people. Like, you guys are never bad, right? And there was like this pause in the room, right? Like, and I think all of them were kind of pondering, like, okay, like, how do I respond here? Like, I don't want to like spoil the bliss of this moment, but like, how can a Christian let a comment like that just go, right? So Cassie spoke up and she said, well, I'm not always good. In fact, sometimes I'm really bad. But that doesn't define who I am. So she went on to share within a few minutes how like nobody is really good. We all have ugliness and sin in our lives. And she shared that walking our new puppy brings that out in her in very specific and ugly ways. She gets angry with the puppy as well as I do. And she said, look, that's not good. We all have that in us. The question really is, like, what are we going to do about it? And then the kids broke out into chaos and the moment was gone. It wasn't a question asking for a response in that moment. Like, what are we going to do about the ugliness in our heart? It was a question that sort of like is designed to sort of like float out there and linger. And Cassie and Amanda were praying. Amanda, by the way, was praying through the whole conversation as Cassie was talking. And then they've been continuing to pray that like that question would haunt them. Not to make them uncomfortable and like miserable, but to point them to Jesus. Because they are not good. And let's just like quit playing the facade that some people are good. And let's just deal with the reality of life that the only solution to our wickedness and our sin is a Savior, and it's Jesus. So that's the how the indirect method works. You kind of just float stuff out and just like let people respond how they will. The direct method, as I said earlier, is a little more, it's a little more aggressive. And some people like one way or other. A direct method example would be maybe a question you could ask a friend like this. Hey, look, I'm really curious. Do you ever think about spiritual matters? Well, they have to reply to that, right? If they say, no, I don't, then you reply back with, well, why not? If they say yes, you say, well, tell me more about that. Like, now you're engaging them in a conversation. You could say something like, tell me, like, what's your spiritual background? Like, were you taught a particular religion as you grew up? I mean, what do you think about God? Again, now they're on the spot. Now they're going to have to reveal their ideas to you. You could say, hey, have you ever wondered what happens to a person after they die? Wow. A bold question that opens a door and almost pulls them into a topic that nobody likes thinking about, death. But man, does that ever point you and take you to the message of Jesus Christ? So, like in all of these examples, you can see you're asking somebody a direct question that's requiring them to engage you in a spiritual conversation. Usually that conversation is going to involve something about the gospel message. Now, I really feel like it's up to each of us to prayerfully determine which method we use at what moments and the relationship that we have with people. Like, but we're all given the role to be a herald if we are followers of Jesus. I kind of think about it this way. There's no law telling us how to be a herald. Instead, if we think back what it said in Romans 7:6, a follower of Jesus now serves in the new way of the Spirit. And serving in the new way of the Spirit is adventurous. It's unpredictable. You never know what's going to happen today if you're following in the new way of the Spirit. You don't know who you might talk to, and you don't even know like how that conversation would evolve. But it is part of being a follower of Jesus that we're mindful of it, that we're prayerful about it, and that we are excited to share the amazing message of who Jesus Christ is. Now, there's probably a couple of topics. One of them is evangelism that makes a lot of Christians basically feel guilty. Anytime I want, you know, if I wanted to make people feel guilty, this is probably one of the topics to talk about because we just feel so defeated in this area so often. And I think the hope that we see in this passage here is that there's lots of ways for us to apply this to our lives in ways that might not be as threatening or as personally scary as you thought. And I'd just encourage you and ask you to pray about how would the Lord ask you to take a next step of obedience in this area in your life. So there's really kind of a couple of responses as we wrap up. The earlier part of the passage really talked about belief in Jesus Christ in our heart and then confessing it. And perhaps that's a step that someone here today feels the Lord wants them to take. But you think, gosh, I've never done that. I need to do that. Another step of application and response is to honestly evaluate ourselves. How am I doing as a herald? Maybe confession could be a part of your response. And then maybe even a prayer asking the Lord to strengthen your confidence and to strengthen you up in boldness so that you could speak on His behalf. A couple of things that would be very good for you to be praying about as we now take communion.